This webcast is a service of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. More information at sd.net.
I will call a Public Utilities Commission meeting to order November 12th, 9:30 a.m., room 413 in the Capitol Building. This is Chairman Nelson. I am present in the meeting room, and we have on the phone Commissioners Feagin and Hansen, so we have a quorum. Is there a motion regarding the minutes of the April 28th meeting?
So moved.
Move to approve. Discussion on the motion. Hearing none. All those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed, nay. Commissioner Hansen.
Aye.
Commissioner Feagin.
Feagin votes aye.
Nelson votes aye. Motion carries. Consumer reports, Deb Gregg.
Thank you, Chairman Nelson. The commission received a total of 58 contacts since the last report was prepared for the October 28th, 2021 commission meeting. 22 contacts related to telecommunication services, 12 contacts related to electric service, 6 contacts related to natural gas service, 3 contacts related to wireless service, 5 contacts related to the Do Not Call registry, 1 contact was related to the carbon pipeline, 2 contacts related to the grain warehouse program, and 7 contacts related to issues that are not regulated by the PUC. 1,713 of the 1,731 contacts received in 2021 have been resolved.
Questions? Hearing none, Deb. Thank you. We will go into our dockets. I think we can pretty much take them in order. Start with TC21-111 in the matter of the application of Middle Mile Infrastructure LLC for a certificate of authority for inter-exchange service in the state of South Dakota. And the question is, shall the commission grant Middle Mile Infrastructure LLC's request for a certificate of authority to provide inter-exchange services in South Dakota? We will start with Middle Mile.
Good morning, Commissioner Nelson, commissioners and staff. Brett Kennecke for Middle Mile appearing this morning. Middle Mile sought and filed an application for authority to transact business. We've engaged in short data requests with staff. There was a name change in the middle there to Meta Platforms, Inc., that we filed a short document on. Not a lot in this docket, and we're hoping for approval this morning. On the phone are Tracy and Courtney to help me answer any questions you might have, but I think we're good to go here.
Excellent. Staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pat Stephenson as staff. Staff has reviewed the filing and recommends approval of Middle Mile Infrastructure's MMI's request for a certificate of authority for inter-exchange long-distance service. With the restrictions that MMI not offer any prepaid services, including prepaid calling cards, and does not accept or require any deposits or advance payments for retail purposes without prior approval of the commission. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Motions?
Mr. Chairman, in TC21-111, I move that the commission grant Middle Mile Infrastructure LLC's request for a certificate of authority to provide interchange services in South Dakota with the restrictions that the Public Utilities Commission staff stated.
Discussion on the motion. Hearing none. All those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed, nay. Commissioner Hansen.
Aye.
Commissioner Feagin.
Feagin votes aye.
Nelson votes aye. Motion carries. We'll go to, let me ask first, Faye Jandrew, have you joined us? Okay.
Yes, I have, Commissioner.
Oh, excellent, Faye, thank you. We will then go to TC21-114 in the matter of the application by Venture Vision, Inc. for approval of a certificate of authority to provide local exchange and inter-exchange telecommunication services in the state of South Dakota. And the question is, shall the commission grant Venture Vision's request for a certificate of authority to provide local exchange and inter-exchange long-distance services in South Dakota? We will go to Venture.
Good morning, Chairman Hansen and members of the commission. This is Darla Pullman Rogers. I am appearing on behalf of Venture Vision, Inc. Just as a reminder, Venture Vision was awarded RDOF support in the FCC's RDOF Phase 1 auction And Venture Vision does intend to offer services to customers within the census blocks it was awarded. They are located in rural Hughes and Spink counties. And the services offered would include local exchange and long-distance services when requested by customers. We have filed our petition. We've responded to data requests. And at this time, we would respectfully request the commission to grant our application for a certificate of authority.
Thank you.
Staff. We will stand by for questions.
Thank you. Staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pat Stephenson of staff. Staff has reviewed the filing and recommends approval of Venture Vision's request for a certificate of authority for local exchange service and inter-exchange long-distance service with the restrictions that Venture Vision not offer any prepaid services, including prepaid calling cards, and does not accept or require any deposits or advance payments for retail purposes without prior approval of the commission, and that Venture Vision be subject to rural safeguards. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? I will start. Ms. Pullman Rogers, the criteria that staff has just laid out, are you okay with those?
Yes, Commissioner, we are okay with those.
Thank you. Other questions? Motions. In TC 21-114, I move that the commission grant Venture Vision's request for a certificate of authority to provide local exchange and inter-exchange long-distance services in South Dakota under the parameters outlined by commission staff. Discussion on the motion. As always, we appreciate a South Dakota company with a great track record willing to move out of their incumbent territory to provide service where broadband service does not exist, and so we appreciate that and support this motion. Additional discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed, nay. Commissioner Hansen?
Aye.
Commissioner Fegan?
Fegan votes aye.
Nelson votes aye. Motion carries. That brings us to EL 21-007. In the matter of the filing by Montana Dakota Utilities, a subsidiary of MDU Resources Group, for approval of the annual update to its infrastructure rider rate. But the very specific question today is, shall the commission approve MDU's proposed Lewis and Clark regulatory asset recovery? Mr. Kaneke.
Good morning again, Commissioner Nelson, commissioners and staff. Brett Kaneke here to introduce this docket. A room full of people from Bismarck here. It's fun to have visitors again after so long without having that kind of travel. Travis is on the line, couldn't be here yet today. And he'll introduce the docket. Darcy Negum's behind me. He'll get up and speak as well. And Garrett and Caitlin and some others in reserve held in the back. So thank you for your time and attention. I'll turn it over to Travis at this point.
Go ahead, Travis.
Thank you, Brett. Thanks, Brett, and good morning, commissioners and staff. Unfortunately, as Brett pointed out, I'm not able to be there with the rest of my group today, so February 2019, Montana, Dakota announced the planned closures of Lewis and Clark Unit 1 and Heskett Units 1 and 2. These are three coal fleet units that are all around 60 years old and becoming relatively more costly than other resource options. Lewis and Clark ceased operations on March 31 of this year, and Heskett will cease operations on March 31, 2022. On November 1, 2019, the company filed a petition requesting approval of deferred accounting treatment of the costs related to the planned closures in docket number EL19-040. The costs are largely plant or employee-related costs. Plant-related costs include accelerated depreciation, offset by excess ADITs stemming from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that are directly related to these plants, and decommissioning costs. Employee-related costs are largely associated with incentives necessary to retain a workforce through the closure dates of the plants. This commission approved the company's petition on January 10, 2020. The 2019 IRP showed a total company annual savings of approximately $20 million, inclusive of the replacement of the coal units with a gas turbine. Nearly one half of that savings was related to fuel and purchase power costs. The fuel and purchase power savings began running through the company's fuel clause adjustment since the Lewis and Clark closure. Montana Dakota has a power purchase agreement, or PPA, in place that is closely matched to the capacity and energy produced by the respective coal units. The PPA is also a component of the fuel clause adjustment. So with that background information, we now move to the docket in front of you today. On February 26th of this year, Montana Dakota filed its annual update to the infrastructure rider. That filing, as revised, was approved by this commission on April 30 with rates effective May 1st. On May 11, 2021, Montana Dakota filed an update to this docket with a proposal to allow the company to use the estimated savings resulting from the closure of Lewis and Clark Unit 1 to offset the amortization of the regulatory assets previously discussed and which were deferred pursuant to the order in docket number EL19-040. The company's proposal results in no change in customers' rates, nor will it significantly impact the company's earnings as the savings will generally match the amortization amount. In order to determine the savings as a component of customers' rates, a revenue requirement for both the Lewis and Clark and Heskett units was determined based on the rates authorized in the company's TCJA filing in docket number GE17-003, which are the current rates in effect. The proposed amortization is composed of two components. First, the amortization of people-related costs over a 36-month period beginning April 2021, and the amortization of plant-related costs, which includes a return component. The sum of the two amortizations will be adjusted to match the revenue requirement that I just discussed. Again, as I noted, the proposal results in no change in customers' rates or company earnings while allowing accelerated amortization of the regulatory asset and will ultimately provide a more seamless transition of the retirement of the coal units and the resolution of the regulatory asset, and will provide a savings to customers over the long term. The complex timing of the closures, one in 2021 and one in 2022, and the addition of another generation resource in 2023 creates challenges in terms of rate stability. The company's proposal aids in rate stability, maintains customer rates, and reduces the number of rate filings necessary to accommodate these changes. Lastly, I'd like to thank staff for working with Darcy and I on this particular docket. And as Brett had stated, Darcy and I are available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Staff.
Thank you. This is Brittany Malhoff for staff. Staff will rely on its memo most recently filed in the docket regarding this issue and recommends approval of the proposed Lewis and Clark regulatory asset recovery, and we are available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. We are going to go to questions. I'm going to start. For Travis, I want to kind of start where maybe you left off, well, or that you mentioned. Obviously, you're closing plants, and you mentioned that you've got a PPA in place to replace that energy. Did I understand that correct?
Yes, Commissioner. We have a PPA in place that will substantially replace both the energy and capacity. There's actually two PPA agreements. And so the first one went into effect June 1, and it is a five-year. And then next year on June 1, it will be increased. And again, what that is was laid out to do was to largely match both the capacity and the energy of both Lewis and Clark and Heskett.
And what type of facility is that?
So that is a coal, a baseload coal unit that's located in North Dakota.
Okay. And is the PPA price locked in, or is that going to at all vary with coal prices?
And I believe Darcy's in the room, and he's kind of the expert on that.
He's actually at the microphone, ready to go.
I was waiting for you, Travis. Well, this is Darcy. So, good morning, Commissioner Nelson, commissioners, commission and staff. The power purchase agreement that Travis is referring to does have fixed prices for capacity and energy, so there's no indexing as far as to any sorts of commodities like MISO energy prices or natural gas. So they are fixed over that term.
Okay, well, you all are off to a good start with your answers. let me go, and I appreciate that. As you know, any conversation you have with me is going to talk about reliability, because that's become an increasing concern of mine. And it sounds like in this particular transition, at least for those 5 years, you've replaced an older baseload with at least a PPA that relies upon baseload. That's important, and appreciate that.
Yep, that's correct.
Okay, so the next line of questioning deals with the accelerated depreciation for Lewis and Clark. I don't know if it's just a mental hang-up, but, I mean, I equate accelerated depreciation for a plant that is being closed to customers paying for a junk pile. That's what it is. If you boil it down, customers are paying for a junk pile. So my question is, how much depreciation is left that needs to be accelerated?
And I can take that question, Commissioner.
Yep.
So upon the announcement, and I'm probably giving you a little bit more background than you're asking, but
that's okay.
February,
this is a big issue for me, so take your time.
Okay. So when we announced the closure of that plant in February of 2019, and we set a cease of operations date, during that period from the announcement until the cease of the operations, essentially what we had to do is we had to increase the depreciation rate to allow that net plant balance to be zero on that date. So that was kind of the goal of that. However, in rates, we didn't change anything. So we charged a certain amount in rates, and then anything over that is considered the accelerated depreciation. And so the total accelerated depreciation as allocated to South Dakota is just under $4 million. And so one of the things that sort of led to that was our last depreciation study that was used in the state of South Dakota was based on a 2014 year-end period. There were incremental investments that were necessary to keep those plants running, but we never changed the depreciation rates. So if we would have been able to change the depreciation rates over that time frame and to have adjusted those to incorporate those additional investments, that $4 million would have been recovered through rates. And so to some extent, Commissioner, it's a little bit of a timing issue. And I certainly understand your comment about they're paying for a pile of junk, but it would have been something that they would have paid for over that time frame had we been in for more rate cases and or been able to adjust those rates over that time frame.
Thank you. I appreciate your stepping through that. So let me see if I'm understanding it correctly. I think I heard you say that by the time of the closure of the plant, which was earlier this year, that the remaining depreciation had been fully accounted for. Is that correct?
Yes. So a portion of that was recovered through rates. which were set in the last rate case, and then the remainder were deferred into the regulatory asset and deferred.
Okay.
And that's the piece that we're amortizing.
Okay, so how much was put into the regulatory asset for the depreciation portion?
So just specific to Lewis and Clark, which is
yes.
the amortization that we're currently asking, is $2.1 million.
Of the original $4 million.
And I'm sorry, the $4 million that I was referencing was provided in a data request, and that would have included both Lewis and Clark and Heskett.
Oh, okay, gotcha. So of the $2.1 million, how much of that are we being asked? Is all of that included in the proposal today, or is there going to be some left after this plays out?
So that would be the total. What we're requesting today is just to use the savings to amortize that out. So I guess there's a number of scenarios of how we proceed after this. If we were to just let this amortize out until it reaches zero, the entire $2 million would be included. If we push it to the next case, so one of the scenarios that Darcy and I worked with staff on was if you went until Heskett 4 went online, then file a case, then we would reset, we would look at, would we do a different amortization period? But ultimately, what we're requesting would be the recovery of the full $2.1 million. It's just the timing of which periods we collect that in would be subject to review this time and or in the future.
Okay, I'm hearing you, but I'm not getting what I'm needing. The plan that we're being asked to approve today, how much of the $2.1 million will be included in this plan? And I'm going to look at Ms. Melhoff. Do you understand what I'm asking? I guess what I want to know is when they ultimately come back to us, whenever that is, how much more money are they going to want to depreciate at that point? Or is all the 2.1 going to be taken care of? Ms. Melhoff.
So, like Travis referred to, we had asked them to look at what happens if they come in for a rate case timed with the Heskett 4. And at that point, the entire balance will not have been amortized through this method. And so I don't, and maybe Travis has it broke out in front of him. I just have the total. I don't have just the depreciation part in front of me, but there would be a balance remaining at that time that would need to be amortized. We could choose to speed it along at the same pace as this method, or we could choose a longer amortization period to put into base rates at that time.
Okay, now I'm starting to understand. We're getting there. So let me ask a couple other questions. Let's say let's take the Heskett off the table. Let's say they're not coming in for a rate case. Using this methodology, how long is it going to take for the 2.1 to be gone?
And Commissioner, right now we're estimating somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 years.
Okay.
And I just would point out, 2.1 is the total. So, again, it's over the number of periods would be the only variable in there. But 2.1, and you mentioned when we come back, are we going to be asking for more money? We would ask for 2.1 less whatever's been amortized to date. So okay. The 2.1 is the total.
Yep, and that leads exactly to my next question that Brittany just talked about. If you come in as you were hypothesizing with staff after Heskett is up and operating, how much of the 2.1 would be left at that point?
And I didn't break it down. So in total, for Lewis and Clark, we have $2.7 million of deferred costs. So that would include the plant and the employee-related.
Yep.
And the we would amortize about $1 million of that, so there'd be about 1.7 or roughly 60% of it left at the time of the...
Probably you're going to be talking $1.5 million-ish.
Yes.
Okay. That, I appreciate that discussion. That helps me understand what I needed to know. One other question. When you did the IRP, your latest IRP that showed that Lewis and Clark should be closed, how did the leftover depreciation, how is it accounted for in that IRP? I mean, obviously that's something that, okay, we're going to close it, so that's a cost to consumers. How did that show up? And I see Darcy's got his mic on, so do you understand the question?
I do, and Commissioner Nelson, and I'll start and probably I'll let Travis jump in. You know, as we looked at the IRP analysis for the 2019 IRP that we did submit, you know, we did look at three different analyses, and part of it was to look at that question itself. You know, one is the normal analysis we would do with our resource planning model. We also took a look at some of the various operational data and competitiveness that the unit had as compared to the markets and at least for other units similarly situated. And then we did a customer revenue requirement model, which would have been what was the customer impact once we had looked at the retirements of the units themselves, replaced it with the combustion turbine, and then looked at that amortization that we would have for that remaining balance. And so, Travis, I don't know if you want to add on to that.
I think you summed it up very well, Darcy. But in that last analysis, which was the customer impact analysis, what we did in that was we assumed a 15-year amortization of that accelerated depreciation. And so in our savings analysis, the impact to customers, that's how that was incorporated into that. So it was a component of that and was incorporated into that.
Thank you. And I'm not so concerned about the length of the time. It's the fact I just want to make sure that the raw dollars were actually part of that calculation and weren't ignored.
I think yes, and they were.
That's the questions I've got at this point. I'm going to go to Commissioner Feagin. Questions?
Thank you. This week I was, the legislature was in town, and we were just talking about how challenging it is to be a utility and really be the changes in federal energy policy and how complicated that becomes running it. And here we see it once again of changing policy, and we've talked about this before, but that $37 million in environmental upgrades is frustrating for ratepayers of cost, and we've talked about that before. So most of this that we have to depreciate out is from the environmental upgrades of trying to keep up with energy policy several years ago, correct? And then, of course, the cost of employees. Is that correct? And when did we put that $37 million in for environmental upgrades?
So, Commissioner Feagin, this is Darcy Nigam. And so the upgrades we're talking about at Lewis and Clark Station did deal with the mercury and air toxic standard. And those upgrades did go in into service, I think it was in 2015 that we're talking about. And so if we would have not have made those upgrades, we would have had to shut the plant down in 2014. So it actually, we needed those to continue to run along to where we are today. You know, and we also looked at those upgrades. You know, that was a part, I think it was our 2011 or 2013 IRP. You know, we had looked at what was the length of time once we put those upgrades in service was at least cost that the plant had to continue to run through. once we made those upgrades. And I think when we did the analysis at that time compared to other alternatives, you know, we were down in something like it was really a 1 or 2 year sort of payback that at least it would have taken, at least in the IRP model, to pick those upgrades. We actually modeled it as a 5 year minimum that the plant had to run before it was retired and replaced with something else. You know, so we're well within when we did the IRP back then and looking at the value of what we would have had for other alternatives to say that we did get, you know, the additional life out of the plant we expected. You know, the difference on the balances that we're talking about is really just the depreciation rates, you know, that we had as once the plant was in service and we were covering in rates versus what we kind of had for an assumption in the model.
I'm gonna just jump in because I think you've really hit on something that's maybe pretty important here. So if we would have used a much faster depreciation rate at that time, say over a five-year period, which I know is pretty fast for this type of an asset, it still would have been the smart and right decision at that point. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's correct, Commissioner Nelson. And I know, Travis, if you want to add anything to that.
No, I think you've summed that up. And the only other point, and Darcy can confirm this, by making those investments, we didn't intend to extend the life of Lewis and Clark at that time. So, again, it was supporting that plant, as Darcy mentioned, and but only to run for its intended lifetime at that, as it was intended at that point.
Thank you. And Commissioner Fegan, I apologize, but they really, I think, found a point that was important to me, and so I appreciate the interjection. Go ahead.
That was my question today. Thank you.
Commissioner Hansen.
No questions. Thank you.
Well, let me, I'm going to ask one additional question of staff. Obviously, I've read your brief, appreciate the memo. I am concerned that, you know, we've got apparently 7 years left to deal with paying for the junk pile, but as has just been testified to, if we'd have paid for it all by now, it still would have been the smart decision. And in hindsight, we probably should have done that, but that's hindsight. Well, let me ask you this. If in 2015, could we have adopted that aggressive a depreciation schedule, or does that just violate every principle of depreciation schedules for this type of an asset?
It would be a quick depreciation schedule. However, I do think we could have based on the life of the plant that was expected at that time, and those investments were not increasing that life. You know, it definitely would have had an impact on rates at that time.
But it would have been paid for by the folks that were utilizing the electricity. Now we got folks paying for it that are not benefiting from that plant. And
correct.
I guess I'd probably have felt more comfortable having the folks that were using it paying for it.
And I would say that, you know, in hindsight, looking back, a learning experience for us as well. If there's a plant nearing the end of its life and there's a post-test year plant addition, probably makes sense to at least evaluate the depreciation rates if those rates were not adjusted for that plant addition.
Sure. Thank you. Fellow commissioners, any other questions based on that discussion? Not hearing any, are there motions?
Mr. Chairman, in EL 21-007, I move that the commission approve MDU's proposed Lewis and Clark regulatory asset recovery.
Discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chairman, in uh, looking back at 2020 hindsight is one thing, certainly a learning experience, as I was going to say, Commissioner Brittany had said. However, this is a beneficial settlement, so we can't discount what may have been to any degree at this juncture, because the ratepayers are going to benefit from this. It has a zero effect, and it gets rid of a large amount of decommissioning costs. And so I think it's a good thing to be doing at this time, and it was a good move back when the recommendation was made, and I appreciate the staff putting in the caveat when we worked on it previously that it should be reviewed again at a later time. And, of course, this is that later time. So commend staff on their work and appreciate, as Commissioner Feagin pointed out, the challenges that are faced by utilities, and obviously those challenges are also faced by our staff when they're attempting to work through all of the machinations of the federal laws. We should also point out that those laws are forever changing. So it's, along with all of the states changing laws from, and I use that as a plural, not referring to South Dakota, but in plural for all of the states that MDU operates in, and as do the other utilities, and the challenges that they face in meeting all of those regulatory changes from one state to the next. It's it has to somehow have an effect on our customers, and I appreciate what they've done here to try and lessen those effects on the consumers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Additional discussion. Let me pick up where Commissioner Hansen left off. I do greatly appreciate staff and the company, to whatever extent, really pulling this issue out to the side so that we could focus on it and ask the kind of deep questions that we've asked today. Very appropriate in that. I am going to support the motion. Coming in today, wasn't sure where I'd end up on this, because as you've heard, I'm deeply concerned about making folks pay for things that are no longer serving them. But I think the case has been adequately made that this was the right decision in 2015, and if we had a more aggressive depreciation schedule at that point, it would have been fully depreciated. The folks that were benefiting would have been the ones paying. At this point, it's not quite matching up, but that is hindsight. We'll learn from it, and certainly no criticism of what was done in 2015. It's just we didn't know. But at the end of the day, it appears that, you know, at least from 2015 through 2021, when the plant was closed, that customers benefited from that plant operating, even though we've got some cleanup costs. You know, it's estimated that we might have this, you know, $1.5 million left over if the next rate case comes in as hypothesized. You know, that's obviously a concern for me, but it is what it is. And again, the folks have benefited from it over the last 6 years. Let me make just a more global statement. For not just MDU, but every IOU that we're dealing with that has coal plants, I mean, I think this is the tip of the iceberg of dealing with this issue. As we move forward and companies try to figure out what to do with their coal plants, and, you know, there's probably a fair amount of depreciation left out there on some of those. And so we're going to have to be dealing with this. And, you know, I am going to look very, very hard at each one of those if we're being asked to have ratepayers pay for an undepreciated asset that's being closed. That's a big jump. As we've shown here today, you can make the case and you'll get my vote. But we're going to ask the hard questions because that's a scenario that just flat makes me uncomfortable. Additional discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I appreciate that the staff and MDU looked at stable rates and looked at the stability of that. I personally believe that the majority of customers are the same, and so the same customers will really be paying that difference, although there has certainly been people moving in to the Dakotas because of less regulation here. So those people may be paying additional costs, but I think the value of living in the Dakotas is probably better than where they have lived before. Jumping through hoops of regulation is frustrating, and utilities, especially our electric utilities, have to look at this all the time, and when administration changes, they have to change. And so just as a regulator, I'm frustrated with federal regulation that made MDU actually pay for $37 million in environmental costs that they knew that they were going to probably close this plant in the future because the inefficiency of an old plant that was built in the 50s. I appreciate the PPA that they have is in coal and that it's base load and that reliability is extremely important to all ratepayers and certainly the commission and MDU. But I just want you to know that I feel for people that have to run an organization on utilities and electric policy right now and how to figure out how the federal administration and your multi-states energy policy continues to change. And people need to know that when those change, the costs go to the ratepayers, and it's not free. And although this is a stable rate and I appreciate what we've done today, in the future, ratepayers need to understand when energy policy changes and environmental law changes, we are looking at reliability issues and then rate increases. So I appreciate your work today, and I also feel for the frustration of running a utility company in today's environment. Thank you.
Thank you. And if I could do a visual underscore exclamation point bold of Commissioner Feagin's last statement about the costs and reliability impact of these changes, I would. She nailed it in that regard. Additional comment? Hearing none, all those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed, nay. Commissioner Hansen?
Aye.
Commissioner Feagin?
Feagin votes aye.
Nelson votes aye. Motion carried, and thank you all for working through that. Brings us DL 21-031 in the matter of the petition of Otter Tail Power Company for approval of the transmission cost recovery rider rate. And the question is, shall the commission assess a filing fee in the amount of up to $50,000 to account for actual expenses incurred in review of this filing commencing from the filing date? We'll go first to staff.
Thank you. This is Brittany Malhoff for staff. Staff is requesting the statutory filing fee. Thank you.
And we'll go to Otter Tail.
Good morning, Chair Nelson and Commissioners. This is Lynn Walters from Otter Tail Power. Otter Tail agrees with the filing fee assessment in the amount of up to $50,000 to account for actual expenses incurred for our 10th annual TCR update.
Thank you. Questions? Motions?
Mr. Chairman, in EL 21-031, I move that the Commission assess a filing fee in the amount of up to $50,000 to account for actual expenses incurred in the review of this filing commencing from the filing date.
Discussion on the motion. Hearing none, all those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed, nay. Commissioner Hansen?
Aye.
Commissioner Feagin?
Feagin votes aye.
Nelson votes aye. Motion carries. That brings us to Grain Warehouse 21-005 in the matter of the request of approval for a settlement stipulation regarding violations of SDC L49-45. And the question is, shall the commission adopt the stipulation and settlement agreement, or how shall the commission proceed? And we will go to Mr. Chambliss or Ms. Reese.
Thank you.
Who's not even listed on this.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. I'm happily filling in for Ms. Edwards as she was unable to attend. As you, I'm sure, are aware, based on the filing, BK Commodities was found to be purchasing grain without a license in South Dakota. However, as soon as PUC staff contacted BK Commodities, they ceased purchasing and worked with staff to become licensed and worked with staff as well to come to a settlement and stipulation agreement for a penalty. Today, we ask the commission to approve that stipulation and settlement and impose the agreed upon penalty. And Mr. Chambliss is available for any additional questions you may have.
Thank you. We will go to BK Commodities.
Yes, Commissioner.
This is Jerry Runyon with BK Commodities. I'll hold you here. Kirk Brack, he is the owner and CEO of.
Yes, do you have any statement to make?
Yes, sir. Just initially, when we purchased the grain, we thought we were purchasing
Excuse me. I'm going to stop. We've got Jerry's name, but who's the gentleman that's speaking?
I'm sorry. This is Kirk, the owner of BK Commodities.
And what's your last name?
Mr. Chairman.
Frex, F-R-E-C-K-S.
Mr.
Chairman.
Fegan.
Could they, I don't know if they're on speaker, but it's really echoing. If they are, is there any way they could pick up the receiver and just talk on the phone? Or?
Yeah, that's a good suggestion. It's coming across kind of scattered. So, Kurt, go ahead, but if you can do it on a handset, might be better.
Yes, sir. I took her off a speaker. So initially, can you hear me okay now?
Yes, much better.
Okay, I apologize for that. Initially, we thought we were purchasing the grain for feed, going as bird seed. We were wrong. Mr. Chambliss called us up, kind of made us aware of the situation, and we ceased purchasing the grain and then moved forward with the process to get the right permits and licenses.
Thank you. Questions? So I'm going to ask you a question. Obviously,
yes,
you had a license in Nebraska, correct?
We did, yes, sir.
And so you were familiar with the licensing process. Were you aware that South Dakota required a license for grain buyers?
We had just started the process of purchasing grain. We were a brokerage, a trucking brokerage. And initially, when we hired our merchandiser, we had asked him on the feed side of it if we could purchase feed without a license. On the grain side of it, we were aware in Nebraska that you cannot purchase grain without a license. So we strictly were going with feed. We were just incorrect in our assumption that bird seed was feed. And we should have, no excuses, we should have called in and made sure before we went ahead with the process.
Okay, I appreciate that. Other questions? Hearing none, is there a motion? In Grain Warehouse 21-005, I move that the commission adopt the stipulation and settlement agreement. Discussion on the motion. Always mystifying to me when we get an out-of-state entity, especially when they've already gone through a licensing process in their home state, that they would come into the South Dakota and not get that all fully figured out before they do business. But I understand his explanation. Bird feed, we're thinking we're feeding birds, so it might be feed. Understand that. And I think appreciate the fact that this company, BK Commodities, was willing to work closely with our staff once those lines of communication were open to get it resolved and bring this stipulation forward. Additional discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed, nay. Commissioner Hansen?
Aye.
Commissioner Fegan?
Fegan votes aye.
Nelson votes aye. Motion carries. No items for commission discussion. I don't see anybody wanting to public comment. The only announcement, next regular meeting will be Tuesday, back in our regular time slot, Tuesday, November 23rd, 9:30 a.m., right here in room 413 of the State Capitol Building. Anything else for the good of the order? If not, is there a motion?
Move to adjourn.
Those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed, nay. Commissioner Hansen.
Aye.
Commissioner Fegan.
Fegan votes aye.
Nelson votes aye. We are adjourned.